WISS Berlin, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation. A civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Sources telling ABC News that a task force comprised of FBI agents and NYPD detectives spoke to Luigi Mangione's mother one day before he was arrested in Pennsylvania and named the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. New details about the last days of the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria.
U.S. officials believe Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov played a major role in getting him to Russia. He didn't tell any of his aides, and he boarded a plane with a disabled transponder so he could escape without being tracked.
ABC's James Longman in Syria. Today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken confirming for the first time that the U.S. has made direct contact with HTS, the rebel group that overthrew Assad, a designated terror organization. A person was arrested after attempting to climb temporary fencing near the White House this morning. Secret Service says there was no impact to any protectees. The climber taken to Metro Police for processing. This is ABC News. An NFL legend says he felt prayers and well wishes after revealing details of a health condition.
Hall of Famer Randy Moss announced December 6th he was stepping away from his analyst role on ESPN because of a health issue. Moss spoke publicly Friday for the first time since.
Your boy is a cancer survivor.
The 47-year-old in a social media video said he had a cancerous mass removed from a bile duct and underwent a Whipple procedure where parts of the pancreas and small intestine are removed.
Been in the hospital for 6 days. I just got out today.
He'll undergo radiation and chemotherapy. Brian Clark, ABC News.
New York's so-called Puppy Mill Pipeline Act will take effect tomorrow. The new law bans the sale of pets, including dogs, cats, and rabbits in stores. It's meant to crack down on puppy mills, which are illegal large-scale breeders where animals are often mistreated and suffer from serious health issues, a group of pet shop owners unsuccessfully trying to stop the law from going into effect. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Lisa Hale with WISS News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WISS.FM.
The Todd Alba Show.
Pat Kreitlow, all your time in the media, television, radio, what have you, what was one or two of the oddest things that people were complaining about?
As a TV anchor, your hair.
You have some of the finest hair around. How could anybody criticize your hair?
Oh, well, because a consultant forced me to change it.
Were there focus groups?
I'm not aware of any focus groups other than the audience, which universally hated it. It was a bowl haircut.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. Mino and the Mayor.
I'm going to admit something that I normally would not admit. A lot of times I don't wear underwear.
We got to go to a break.
I don't have a cart, and I'm carrying this stuff.
Yeah.
I got my finger in the loop holding my pants up because they would literally go down. And twice people stopped me. Hey, John Mino, as I'm trying to hold my pants up and hold my stuff in my arms.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday morning 6 till 9 on 97.9 WGBW and 98.3 WISS.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Even though it's illegal under state law, more Wisconsinites are getting abortion care through telemedicine. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
An 1800s Wisconsin law caused a temporary statewide ban on abortion services after Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. But Jenny Higgins with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Collaborative for Reproductive Equity says even after the ban was lifted in 2023, demand for abortion pills in Wisconsin remained high.
Suggesting that even when brick and mortar facilities are offering abortion care in our state, telehealth abortion still is a really important service that many people in our state are taking advantage of through these Shield laws.
There have been about 130 orders for abortion pills per month made through Shield Law providers since July of 2023, according to WeCount data. There have also been reports of stockpiling nationwide since the election. With only 4 abortion clinics statewide, 96% of Wisconsin counties don't have an abortion provider, and about 70% of Wisconsinites of reproductive age live in a county without an abortion clinic. Higgins says while Shield Law clinicians provide critical and affordable care to Wisconsinites who grapple with numerous restrictions to abortion, attempts to criminalize both providers and patients are expected, with Black and brown patients at the highest risk.
And we know historically that Black and brown women are the most likely to be criminalized during pregnancy, whether that pregnancy is ending in abortion or birth. And so I think we need to pay great attention to the ways in which some of the pregnant people with the least social power could be putting themselves at risk.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-30s, a bit breezy out of the southeast. Tonight, rain mixed with snow and temps around 34. For Sunday, cloudy and 42. Clouds and 42 again for Monday with a slight chance of rain, 33 on Tuesday.
Currently 33 degrees.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Fox Valley's home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey there, political orphans, swing voters, independents, that whole gang. Welcome to special edition of Lost in the Middle. We're going to do a countdown between the middle of September and work our way up till Election Day. And we've sort of switched out the format. This won't be storytelling the way we do things. But instead, what I'm doing is talking to some of the smartest political podcast hosts in the country. But before we go there, I want to tell you a quick story. When I left Congress, it was sort of running up to the 2000 election. And I got a call from a good friend of mine named Brady Williamson. And Brady said, I've got an idea for you. What's that? He said, let's try to get a political debate in Madison because it would be interesting in the 2000 election. And Brady had worked for the Clintons for years and was a Democratic operative. And I said, let's rock and roll. So we reached out to what was then called the Political Debate Commission, which everybody thought was an official arm of the federal government. But instead, it was just a cozy room between a longstanding Republican and a longstanding Democratic operative who figured out a way to make money on this. And the deal was you had to raise $500,000 because the presidential debate is a television operation. And so the first thing we had to do was raise, I don't know, I think it was $200,000 to show that we were serious, which actually was much easier than we thought it would be. We had a couple of large Madison businesses step forward and then some foundations locally. And then we were ready to rock and roll. And then out come the folks who actually scout the presidential debate. And so we wandered around Madison looking for venues. And so the whole Madison community was geeked about the idea. And then they wanted to show off the new Madison Civic Center, which had been designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And they walked in the room and we probably spent maybe 3.5 minutes in it, because if you've ever seen anything designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, it may be brilliant, but it's weird. And every section we looked, there was a column or a weird thing. Walked out of that. Then went to the old Oscar Mayer Theater. Yes, Madison was the home of Oscar Mayer Wieners and the Wienermobile. And they liked that a lot, but it was a really cool old building and would have great angles to look down on the audience and looked very ornate and very rich. And then it turned out by the time they built out the stage downstairs, there'd be no time for sitting. So that went out the window. And so we ended up with the Madison Expo Center, which was just basically a big box. So it was a weird year because the Olympics were that fall and the World Series was really late. And so they decided at the end of the day, they're going to have to do all of the four debates, three presidential and one vice presidential, in a very compressed time frame. So we're sitting around like the NFL draft waiting for the phone to ring. And they pick up the phone and say, Brady, Scott, we've got some great news for you. Okay, we want you to host the vice presidential debate. It's like, who the hell watches the vice presidential debate, much less trying to raise $500,000 to stage it? And as we're looking through sort of depressed glasses at one another, they say, here's the date. And they pick a weekend in October in a great Wisconsin story that's not a punchline. It was the World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin. We were off the hook. You could not find a hotel room because people with trailers and pickup trucks were driving their prize Holsteins to Dane County, Wisconsin to show them off. So our prize for doing that was actually we got tickets to go to the presidential debate in Boston, Al Gore and George Bush. The highlight of the night for me personally was that Christie Brinkley sat in front of me with purple sort of eggplant colored leather pants. And let's just say it was not a particularly good look. But the defining moment of the debate was Al Gore doing this every time George Bush started to answer a question. And it's literally graded by historians as one of the 10 worst debate moments in U.S. presidential history. So we never ended up with the debate here, but we just all watched the debate. And I want to turn around to my guest, Andrew Heaton, who's actually calling us in from Scotland, from a phone booth in a men's businessman's club, I take it is, Andrew?
I'm at the Royal Scots Club, which is just a nice, stuffy club that has allowed me to become a member. I like to work out of here, and being a humble boy from Oklahoma, I find it endlessly funny to talk to old British men in three-piece suits. So I come to Scotland to avoid the Texan weather for about a month a year, and then I work out of here.
Well, you can tell by the early introduction. So Andrew actually hosts a podcast much aligned with us called The Political Orphanage. So that means my political orphans actually live in his political orphanage when they turn into his podcast, which is terrific. Mm-hmm. He's been a stand-up comedian. He's performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. He's written a bunch of books, including one that's called Laughter is Better Than Communism. And he actually opened up for William Shatner, who said, wow, that Andrew guy, he's pretty funny. But the cool thing is, and most people won't know this, and I actually know this because my youngest son spent some time in comedy, is you performed with Upright Citizens Brigade in L.A., which is sort of the West Coast version of Second City, who don't know it. So,
yeah, it was New York, but yes, the UCB, it had outposts on both coasts, and I got improvisational training from the good people at UCB. I have a certificate saying I'm funny. I have it on my wall. UCB is a fish. I'm licensed to be funny by UCB.
That's terrific. Worked on the Hill for Tim Holden, who's an old buddy of mine, who was a Democrat from Pittsburgh. We used to play in the congressional baseball game together. And Tim actually had one of the worst moments I've ever seen because he and Bill Jefferson, another Democrat from Louisiana, who later on got sentenced to prison for racketeering, but that's an entirely different story. Tim was at first base. Bill was at catcher. Somebody popped up in the middle of the first base and home plate, and they collided head on. And Steve Largent was playing with us, former NFL football player, who said that was the ugliest collision I've ever seen, worse than anything I'd ever seen in the NFL. And they both, Tim got gashes, Jefferson got teeth knocked out, everything in the world. So now that I've completely wasted everybody's time for 8 or 9 minutes with a story that went nowhere, let's talk about your impressions of the debate. Does it really matter? Did it really change anybody's mind?
Yes, I think they do. So I was very skeptical of the debates up until about 3 months ago. I'm one of these people that is angry at the Presidential Commission on Debates, because it seemed to me that they were intentionally icing out any third-party candidates that would come in, and I was ruffled about that. I was angry that Gary Johnson had approached whatever metric they needed, and then they immediately put it up to 10% in order to ice him out. And was taking the rather cynical view of, like, look, everyone in America has made up their mind about Biden and Trump. This is, before Biden dropped out. No one needs any additional information. It's not as if Trump is some sort of coy, opaque figure that we don't know a lot about. And I have changed my tune on that completely. I watched the debate between Biden and Trump, and I had been likewise kind of skeptical about the whole Biden mental acuity thing, because that sounded to me like kind of a made-up Republican talking point. And then I, like much of the rest of the country, watched the president's brains drain out of his ears like motor oil and went, oh, this the apparently they were right about this. We have been gaslit, America. So I thought that the debate did a really good public service at that point. The most recent, so for that reason, I think the debates are good, just because they do allow you to see if somebody's truly crazy or not. I don't think that they're particularly salient for policy discussions, and the latest debate was not salient for policy discussions, but I think that they could be useful in that regard. In terms of pushing people to vote in a particular direction, yes. My understanding is that last-minute voters tend to be disproportionately affected by the personalities they see on display at the debates, and by bombardments of advertising that get them the last couple of weeks. So for most people that are plugged into politics, and I would imagine that that's the bulk of your audience, they probably have their own internal compass that they're using and some kind of metric they're using to make decisions in terms of who they're going to vote for that involves ideology and policy goals and character or something to that effect, right? I think there is a group of people, and they're ultimately who's going to determine this election, which are not nearly that attuned to politics. And so for them, they're running a lot of this off of gut feelings and vibes. And in that capacity, I think it's going to really benefit Kamala Harris, because my personal suspicion is I'm telling all the Scots while I'm here, I'm putting it 60-40 on Kamala Trump. I think she's going to take it. It's going to be razor thin, but I think that she's probably going to take it. And my rationale for this is that I think the last minute voters, they're not reliably Republican or Democrat, are going to basically go, I don't know, I associate Trump with old screamy guys. I don't like that. Let's give this new lady a try. She seems sane. And Kamala did a good job of appearing sane and reasonably normal for the course of the debate. And so I think that that vibe will work to her advantage.
So who's left that hasn't made up their mind?
I think it is the swing, like the truly swing voters, right? So like I'm an independent, and I'm a big critic of the two-party system, and I will kind of join people in breathlessly talking about how wonderful it is that independents are gaining traction and they're now the largest voting bloc. They're larger than Republicans or Democrats. But when you really look at it, the majority of independents, probably about 80%, are reliably Republican or Democratic voters, but they just really don't like the party. And so it's almost like a protest that they're registering as an independent, but they're going to vote Republican or Democrat. That leaves about 20%. And half of those people, I think, are like me, where we are very plugged in, but we have our own aberrant, weird Rorschach test that we're applying to American politics, which means we're not permanently in the pocket of either camp. But I think that there's another group of people that for them, they're living their lives and they're thinking about work and thinking about their kids. And they're not really thinking about politics. And so they're a lot more affected by how they would judge a used car salesman, which is like, does this person seem honest? Does this person seem like they're going to be the person who's going to sell me the right car? Are they going to swindle me? Can they get things done? Are they going to be a good boss? They're going with personality attributes to a great extent. And I think those are the kind of swing voters that will be swayed by the debate.
I think for folks who are political junkies, it's hard to understand. I mean, I keep running into people who say there can't be any undecided voters. They can't be, but there are. And I think people have a hard time comprehending that. And, you know, the interesting thing is if you talk to political consultants, I mean, I spent a bunch of time arguing with Mike Murphy over this idea, whether they're independents or really they're just closet Republicans or closet Democrats. If you talk to the folks at Arizona State and Tom Riley, who runs the only political science department in the country, which has a specific study of independent voters, he'll tell you there are a significant chunk. And if you look, you can see it for yourself. If you look at the vote totals in 2012, they went dramatically for Obama. Then they turned around and shifted to Trump. And then in 20, they shifted around and voted for Clinton. So I do think there's a group that is permanently disengaged with either of the major political parties. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Andrew, I want to talk to you about why I think your analysis is wrong on the debate, because I want to tell you the two issues that I think are trouble for Harris.
Great.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Pat Kreitlow, all your time in the media, television, radio, what have you, what was one or two of the oddest things that people were complaining about?
As a TV anchor, your hair?
You have some of the finest hair around. How could anybody criticize your hair?
Oh, well, because a consultant forced me to change it.
Were there focus groups?
I'm not aware of any focus groups other than the audience, which universally hated it. It was a bowl haircut.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Dom Salvia Show.
Dr. Susan Webb Yackey, what advice would you give everyone who has an opportunity to engage in conversation with folks, and sometimes we don't think alike?
One state of mind is to be curious about it. How did you come to that point of view? And the other is humility. This idea that we don't have all the answers.
The
Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Well, welcome back, and we're just beginning our conversation with Andrew Heaton, who's a great political podcast host on a podcast called The Political Orphanage. He's done a lot of comedy work. He's written a whole bunch, and he and I think share a lot of sort of similar framing of how we think this election goes. So
I'll even add to that, Scott. You were kind enough to come on my program, The Political Orphanage, and you think so similar to me that it kind of freaked me out. And at one point, I began postulating that you might be me from the future who'd come back to talk to me in the past. It was very unnerving.
Well, we can probably sell that as a pilot to CBS or somebody.
Yeah, right? I like that. Time-traveling pundits, yeah.
So there's sort of two framing things you have to do in elections. Well, there's actually three. I mean, if you and I are running against each other, I have to define you. Right. And then I have to define who I am. And then the third thing is you have to figure out what issues you're running on. And sometimes that's good for you and sometimes it's bad for you. And I think the problem for Harris is going to be as we get closer to those undecided voters, it's people who weren't thrilled with what the economy's looked like the last 4 years. And I think I'm not a fan of the former president, as anybody who listens to this show knows. But I just think at the end of the day, it's people who are still worried about the cost of gas, the cost of bread, about taking their kids to McDonald's, about canceling a summer vacation. I think those folks are going to look and say, wow, Trump's really a strange guy, but it was better than he was president.
That could be the case. I mean, I think one of the other things that Kamala is doing that is a strategic decision that may or may not benefit her is she's intentionally trying to remain a kind of Schrodinger's candidate, where when she ran in 2020, as Trump has pointed out multiple times, she ran as a very progressive candidate and then flamed out before Iowa. Whereas now she has tacked much more to the center and is emphatically in favor of fracking and all of the things that more centrist Democrats would favor. When I was at the Democratic National Convention last month, it was lots of really good vibes. Everybody was really happy. The AOC wing of the party was really happy with her. They were thrilled with Tim Walz. The Obama free trade wing of the party liked her. Everybody liked her. And so she had a kind of internal rationale not to cease being a quantum candidate and really define herself because she'd alienate one wing or the other. And she's kind of started doing that because she's released some policy papers, so you can now actually get a feel for what she's allegedly going to do. But I think she's kind of playing that same card at the general election. And I do think it'll help in terms of the people that are just going off of vibes because they're just going to see a fresh face and go, I don't know, let's try a new one. In terms of the economy, you might have a point there. The polls indicate that people associate Trump with a better economy. I have a lot of qualms with that in that I am very much in favor of free trade and think tariffs are stupid. So I have a lot of problems with his economic model. But that seems to be earned or unearned the benefit that he gets. He gets like a +5 in economy.
Yeah, which is interesting. And then the other issue, which isn't hot for her either, is immigration. And so that's why I think she did a marvelous job in the debate making the case for the case against the Republicans on abortion, which I thought was really the high moment of the campaign. And now let's talk about the low moment of the campaign. People eating pets and casseroles in Ohio, which seems, You know, I appreciate the fact that CBS fact checked it, but did you really need to fact check that?
That, all right. There's two ways we can look at American politics going forward. We can either be very sad or we can find it very funny. I've decided to find it very funny. I have decided to treat this more like a sitcom than a Black Mirror episode. And looking at it with the sitcom analysis, I thought that whole moment was very funny because the precipitating moment to that was Kamala obviously baiting Donald Trump in a way that you could see from a million miles away, where I don't remember what the actual thing they were discussing was. Probably it wasn't the border. It was something else, the economy. I don't know. And she went, I invite people to watch a Trump rally, because what you will find is that people leave early because they find it boring and exhausting. And I saw that and I was like, there's no, like, any other political candidate would go, well, that's just, you know, like that's not really pertinent to what we're discussing here. But Trump could not, like, no, in a million years, Trump cannot let that go. So he immediately had to come back with, like, our rallies are amazing. And then after that, he was so addled, that's when he stepped into the they're eating cats line. And yes, I think the weird analysis that I have been seeing of the debate is where a lot of the pro-Trump people are saying, you know, the moderators were fact-checking Trump much harder than Kamala Harris. And I'm like, yes, I agree on that. However, the whole they shouldn't have fact-checked him as hard on immigrants are eating cats line, to me, is just not a really good strategy. I'm saying, like, if only they hadn't fact-checked him on that, he'd be doing okay. I don't think so.
But the flip side of that, and I thought CBS really, or excuse me, ABC did a pretty good job and tried to balance it. And I think the mics being muted, while it didn't make for as much street theater, at least you got to hear what people were saying rather than it's my turn to talk. But I was troubled by the fact they asked one question about her policy flips. She answered it on fracking without pushing her. And then they never went back to the other stuff, which I thought led her off far too easy. And that bothers me. I mean, I generally, as somebody who spent 14 years in journalism, still spend lots of time on the journalism board at Northwestern University. I find a lot of the coverage, unfortunately, skewed. Do you agree with me on that?
Wholeheartedly, yes. I know you played board games when you were in high school, Scott. Did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons by chance?
I wasn't that weird. I played Risk and games in a couple
of times. Nice. I was a big Risk guy. In D&D, you've got character attributes, and you'll roll your character attributes of how strong you are and how smart you are. And in American politics, Republicans just kind of get a +5 automatically on the economy, and they get a +5 on defense. And Democrats just get like a +10 on integrity from the media. Like, they just, you by virtue of being a Democrat, you automatically get kind of a soft glove there. I didn't think that the moderators were in the can for Kamala. But I agree. I think, generally speaking, that the people that are running those debates are probably trying to be even-handed, but they're personally very invested in Trump losing, and as a result, they're overzealous in fact-checking him. And I think that goes back to, like, Romney and Obama. So I don't disagree with that. I think that the media scrutiny is a lot harder. It's arguably one of the benefits of Trump, because I'm also not a Trump guy, but one of the benefits of Trump is that I think he actually compels journalists to do their job. When Biden, like, I as a, like, turn your head and squint level journalist, like, I could technically be a journalist depending on how you're looking at me. I view myself as in a positive adversarial relationship with politicians, the same way that a prosecutor is in a positive adversarial relationship with a defense attorney. There's an emergent order that comes out of the system by virtue of both parties squaring off against each other. So I don't want to take the position of just liking people in power from one side and disliking the other. I think we should always be putting pressure on them. And when Biden won the last election, the fact checker for CNN just went on vacation. And I looked at that and was like, but this is the exact time that you should be fact checking the incoming guy when he's like, this is the time to really. But the attitude was the threat is over. The threat is over. We can all go home now. And yes, I think that becomes a big problem with legacy media.
Well, and I think there's a big problem with legacy media, too, in terms of diversity. Right. You saw the big kerfuffle when one of the NPR editors quit, because when he did a check of where his fellow reporters were registered, you can do that at the political rolls in Virginia and Washington and Maryland, because it's all a public record. There were no Republicans. It was 93-0. And famously, you know, in the study that was done by Nate Silver, it was only 6% of journalists self-identified as Republicans. So not that they're making things up, but it would help if they had a little different perspective and didn't think the world would be solved by five more government programs.
Welcome to the Fox Valley's Real News and Great Conversation, WISS.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Sources telling ABC News that a task force comprised of FBI agents and NYPD detectives spoke to Luigi Mangione's mother one day before he was arrested in Pennsylvania and named the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. New details about the last days of the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria.
U.S. officials believe Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov played a major role in getting him to Russia. He didn't tell any of his aides, and he boarded a plane with a disabled transponder so he could escape without being tracked.
ABC's James Longman in Syria. Today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken confirming for the first time that the U.S. has made direct contact with HTS, the rebel group that overthrew Assad, a designated terror organization. A person was arrested after attempting to climb temporary fencing near the White House this morning. Secret Service says there was no impact to any protectees. The climber taken to Metro Police for processing. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Packers head to Seattle. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Another game in prime time for Green Bay. The 9-4 Packers take on the 8-5 Seahawks tomorrow night at Lumen Field. Packers wide receiver Bo Melton spent his rookie season after being drafted by Seattle and says it's definitely a loud, noisy place to play.
It's real loud, Lumen Field. It'd be shaking. It'd be rocking in there for sure. It's just, I'll say it's definitely a loud crowd. They love the Seahawks. Great atmosphere for sure to play in.
Packers defensive back Jair Alexander is out for the game, still dealing with a knee injury. He tried to make a comeback a few weeks ago against the Bears, but had to leave after just a few series. Head coach Matt LaFleur.
I just didn't want to have another situation like Chicago where you're in there for a couple plays and it puts a bind on every other area. Puts you some guys in some tough spots in regards to special teams. And then also you want to get the guys that are going to have to go play. We want to get them the reps. So I think that's an important part of it.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-30s, a bit breezy out of the southeast. Tonight, rain mixed with snow and temps around 34. For Sunday, cloudy and 42. Clouds and 42 again for Monday with a slight chance of rain. 33 on Tuesday.
Currently 33 degrees.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported recently on the impact of Shelby County versus Holder, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision invalidating Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Anticipating even more erosion of the VRA, some states have passed their own state VRAs. It's not only the dismantling of Section 5, the preclearance requirements for states with a history of discrimination. The conservative justices also made proving racial gerrymandering harder under Section 2, and they've made it easier for a state legislature to dilute minority voting power. And in the lower courts, more cases attempting to keep individual voters from bringing voting rights lawsuits under the VRA are pending. With dwindling protections from the federal government, California, Washington, Oregon, Virginia, New York, Connecticut, and Minnesota have enacted state VRAs. Michigan, Maryland, New Jersey, and Florida have efforts underway. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund recommends that state VRAs should have pre-clearance requirements for municipalities which have patterns of discrimination. Rules should include a prohibition against vote denial or dilution through gerrymandering, strong protections against intimidation or deception, language assistance, a statewide database to make evidence-based decisions on election administration, and a directive to the state judiciary to support pro-voter and pro-democracy decisions. We have the recommendations at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, folks, I'm Charlie Behrens. This is Civic Media, and here's my conversation with the president and executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Buddy Heffaker. Where did he like become a good writer? Do we know that?
He was really open to challenging editing. So he'd have his wife read it. He'd have his students read it. He'd have colleagues read it, and he would take that feedback. And then you can see after those edits, you know, that he would rework the essay. So it was really kind of a labor of love in that he put the time and energy into, you know, coming up with the content, putting it on paper, letting it digest, then taking feedback and constantly improving it.
That's really cool as a writer listening to that process. And, you know, I think that's what, he wasn't just throwing the first thing out of his mind saying this will connect with people. He was testing it hard with people. And that's what I think made this thing go from just his ideas about the environment to actually resonating with people as he tested it like that.
You know, you're exactly right. And one of the things I love is, again, when you kind of get deeper into Leopold and you see his other writings, some of which then would get reshaped and ultimately appear in a St. County Almanac. You know, when he's writing for the Garden Club, he expresses these ideas in one way. When he's writing to the civil engineering department, it's different. When it's to a general hunting audience, it's different. And so, you know, kind of knowing your audience, sometimes we forget about, we just try to, like you say, come up with that one right line and think it's going to work everywhere. And, you know, we got to connect with those people we're really trying to reach and communicate in a way that they're going to be interested and willing to receive it.
Yeah, and I think one of his best tools in doing that is coming from his own admission that he's messed things up himself. And that would be it's one of my favorite essays, but it's like thinking like a mountain, you know, that's kind of like, that's the big one. But this is basically a story where he kills a wolf. And because back then you saw wolves, you'd kill them, you know, because less wolves meant more deer. And the ending of it, I think, first of all, yeah, I mean, I'd almost want to read the whole freaking thing, but I won't. I just want to read the ending of it because I think this is really cool. We all strive for safety, prosperity, comfort, long life, and dullness. The deer strives with his supple legs, the cowman with trap and poison, the statesman with pen. The most of us with machines, votes, and dollars, but it all comes to the same thing, peace in our time. A measure of success in this is all well enough and perhaps is a requisite to objective thinking, but too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Perhaps this is behind Thoreau's dictum, in wilderness is the salvation of the world. Perhaps this is the hidden meaning in the howl of the wolf, long known among mountains, but seldom perceived among men. I think it's so freaking cool because it basically says, you know, like we need wolves. Like without wolves, the land goes to shit, and the deer you're even trying to save, they go to shit, or the cattle you're trying to preserve, they go to shit. And also the wolf is kind of that natural regulator. Maybe that wolf is getting your deer because that needs to happen in order to save more of the deer. And we see that with chronic wasting disease. Yeah. And we see that with sort of the overgrazing of certain lands and what happens to those lands. They get degraded. So it's almost like the thing that was here before us knows more than us, that being the mountain and the general environment.
Well, again, I love what you're picking up on. I think that's one of the other beauties is, I kind of sometimes describe a Sand County Almanac as like you're going for a walk with your grandfather in the woods, right? He's kind of like pointing things out and you're learning these lessons. It's not real preachy, but there's always kind of some education that happens. But then in other parts of the book, he kind of puts you, and this is challenging to do, but he kind of helps you try to see the world from the deer's eyes or from the mountain's eyes. And so like all of a sudden, like, wow, like, this is challenging. Like, it's not just how I see the world. Like, I got to start to think of these other vantage points. And I think that was relatively new at the time Leopold was writing that kind of device to put people outside of themselves and try to understand their world around them. And then, yeah, the core point of that whole essay is that, you know, is kind of to reveal he had blood on his hands. He didn't always behave exactly perfect or know the right way to behave. But as he learned, he was able to improve and refine his thinking and actions.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the humility that a lot of people in the environmental world don't often have, you know, because it's easy to get. And I would say I could be just as guilty of not only doing the bad environmental stuff, but being all, feeling like I'm doing the right thing and other people aren't about it just as much as anybody. But so I think it's good to see that sort of admission of it in this book. And the phrase like the most of us with machines and votes and dollars, that hasn't changed at all. So it's fun to see like the timelessness in this thing, especially 75 years now. I don't know why I just looked at my watch when I said 75 years from now. Like I was trying to how much
does it
time
feel
has
that long
been
since we started talking, Charlie?
No. It's just I anytime I am talking about time, I reflexively look at my watch.
You know, one of the other neat things about the book and its legacy that has been fun to kind of reflect on and highlight this year is your point about kind of Wisconsin leading the world and kind of being this ability to kind of attract people's attention and consideration. And, you know, the book has been translated into 16 different languages now. So, you know, Leopold, and when you read the book, it is very Wisconsin focused. I mean, if you've lived in the state very long, there are images that he will describe like, oh, yeah, I saw that. I saw that up north. Or I saw that down by Madison or driving to Milwaukee. And so he's literally taken Wisconsin to the world now through these translations and other people in other parts of the world trying to think about these conceptual aspects about how we relate to each other in the natural world, but also getting this glimpse into what life in Wisconsin might be like and what a cool place it would be. And we literally have people come from all over the world now to see the farm and the landscape that inspired that book.
That's pretty cool. So tell me about that, by the way. Tell me about the farm and tell me like when Aldo bought it and what it was before and what it is now.
So he was teaching at the university. They had a hunting cabin down in Arkansas, and that was, of course, a stretch to get down there at that point. And so they were looking for a little farm where the family could go on the weekends. And they found 35 crummy little acres along the Wisconsin River, kind of equidistant between Baraboo, Portage, and Wisconsin Dells, for those that know that region. And they bought it. There was basically no vegetation on the property. The farmer had lost the land to the bank for back taxes. It's on pure sand, effectively, from the Wisconsin River. And there was this one little structure on it. There was a chicken coop because literally there was frozen chicken manure in it with the first time they went to visit it. And they kind of cleaned it up and it became what they called the shack. It was just enough to get them out of the elements. And then they started planting thousands and thousands of trees, restored prairie, planted a sugar maple grove and kind of restored it back to health. It's looked at as one of the early ecological restoration projects in the world. Replicating some of the stuff that was happening at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. And that's kind of his, you know, he'd been a public servant with the Forest Service. He'd been an educator. Now here he's just a regular old guy trying to take care of the farm, having to pay for all the work and, you know, maintain the property. And he begins to realize that, hey, this conservation thing is going to take everybody. And so that's when he starts writing these essays that are designed to reach, he'd been writing technical papers. These essays were designed to reach more general audiences and engage people in these ideas. And so it's that kind of intersection of the family farm and its restoration with trying to reach a bigger audience that inspires him to write the book.
And he wrote it right before his death, right?
Yeah. So he'd worked on it for almost 15 years, been rejected 4 to 5 times, kind of depends on how you read, either rejection letters or no responses. And yeah, 1 week before he passed away of a heart attack at the age of 61, he finally received word from Oxford University Press that they would publish his manuscript. So
wow,
he very nearly never saw it. Well, and actually never saw it in print. He almost didn't even know it was going to be printed.
And he died fighting a fire, didn't he, on his buddy's land?
So the shack and farm is along the Wisconsin River. It's now National Historic Landmark. The site where he passed away is where the Leopold Center now stands. And we kind of, it's our offices and interpretive center. People come here before they go down to the shack. And we have a memorial site where he suffered a heart attack. There was a farmhouse here. A brush fire escaped, and he and his wife and youngest daughter came over to help suppress the fire. They kind of broke up. Leopold suffered a heart attack and died while trying to suppress the fire to protect it from kind of getting out of control.
It's the most Midwest way to go out, man.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I'll come over and help you fight that fire. No problem. Oh, there we go. Who was it? Was it Curly Lambeau? I think Curly Lambeau also died cutting his neighbor's grass, I think.
No kidding. Yeah,
I think so. I think
communitarian, civic minded individuals that.
That's the way you want to go out. You know?
Yeah,
that's nice.
By the way, since I know the Packers are a strong theme through your programs.
Yeah.
The best we know is that in 1937, Aldo Leopold did not know who the Packers were, because he asked his son Starker, who was listening to a game on the radio, who are these Packers? So
really,
he wasn't clued in quite yet. I don't know if that changed in the last decade of his life.
How did you know that? Did was that in his journals?
It's a story that, yeah, his oldest son Starker would tell.
That's fun. That's
so
funny.
That, the kids knew who the Packers were. They weren't all that clueless.
So how does it work now? I mean, his kids have all since passed, but you are sort of in control of all his writings and everything. Is that accurate or no?
So then, yeah, 1980, all five of the kids were amazing scientists and conservationists in their own right. They all had decorated careers. We just lost the youngest child, Estella, this last year at the age of 97. Productive for long periods of time in their own disciplines. But in 1982, kind of recognizing that their father's work was just becoming more and more important, they created the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and they entrusted it with two assets. One was the farm, and the other was the rights to their father's writings. So the Leopold Foundation, now that operates out of Baraboo and the Leopold Center, we continue to own and manage the farm, and we work with neighboring landowners to kind of manage about 4,000 acres for wildlife habitat purposes. We have people come to see the shack from all over the world and kind of learn what happened there and the history of this book and the idea of a land ethic. And then we're the executor of his literary estate. So we help bring the book out in new languages and new formats and, just keep the idea alive.
Who's got like his he wrote a bunch of journals and all that sort of stuff. Where's all that stuff with?
Most of that is held at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in the Steenbach Library. So they house the physical connection. We've digitized all of that. So if you want to go thumb through his journals, it's all digitized and transcribed on their website. And then we have a few of them on display at the center just, for demonstration purposes.
That's crazy that, did he say he wanted his journals published? Is there any weird stuff in there?
We keep looking. We haven't found anything.
He probably put those in a different box.
Maybe. Yeah. Those were destroyed at some point.
Burned in that fire or something. That's really interesting that you can go do that, though. Roughly how many pages are we talking if you wanted to read everything he had ever written?
Oh my goodness. I should know that. It's a lot.
Have you read it all? Have you read everything?
Well, there are scholars who have. I have read a fair amount of it and kind of dipped in and out, but I get to use their scholarship and research so that I haven't had to read every word.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha. That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah.
It's very cool to see. And then you got your start. What was your personal journey?
So I grew up in Central Illinois. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to admit that, though. I do have my own Packer origin story. My second grade teacher, as I tell the story. So my mother just kind of refuted this. So I'll put it out here to your audience. Maybe somebody can help vet this, though. If I'm wrong, I'm going to be really shattered and disappointed. But my second grade teacher, Mrs. Levante in Champaign, Illinois, was, as I say it, was Bart Starr's niece.
Oh.
So from, though I was in Bears country, from second grade on, I have been a Packers fan. Back to Lynn Dickey and Randy White and, you know, James Lofton, James Jefferson. I was a Packers fan through and through. So,
buddy, you made a good decision.
Yeah. Thankfully now. Any rate, I was a pretty suburban kid and in high school, got a random job at a soil testing laboratory because it paid well. And in the 80s, there weren't many summer jobs. And I got interested in soil science and agronomy. And so then went to Purdue University and studied kind of landscape architecture and plant ecology. And then went to the University of Illinois for graduate school because Madison wouldn't give me any money. So That was
Midwest cheap.
Yep. And, you know, it turned out good. I went to school in Illinois and get to live in Wisconsin. If I would have gone to school up here, who knows? Maybe I would have had to live in Chicago. That'd be terrible. And I came to the Leopold Foundation right as Nina Leopold Bradley, one of Aldo's children who had retired back to the area and kind of been the family storyteller and convener for decades, was ready for her second retirement. And I was supposed to be here for a field season, and 28 years later, they haven't figured out how to get rid of me.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. You've evaded it that long, huh?
Yeah.
You must be doing a real good job there. So congratulations on that. What do you see as, so you guys, you're preserving the works, you're preserving and spreading sort of a Sand County Almanac and other works of Aldo Leopold around, and you are preserving the land. And what other initiatives do you guys see as important? Like, if you were to have unlimited money and take on maybe another thing, what would you say are the biggest environmental concerns right now?
Well, so for starters, we don't preserve the land. You really only preserve pickles and we try to manage the land.
Manage it. Yes, of course. Yeah, yes.
Because it's a dynamic system. And then another important project I want to get out there is we have a program called My Wisconsin Woods, where we're helping woodland landowners all across the state of Wisconsin kind of understand what they can do on their own property, whether it's 5 acres or 500 acres, to have a healthy forest, do sustainable forestry practices, better wildlife management activities. And so we're connecting landowners up all across the state with different resources in their area and kind of helping to illuminate what they can and might want to consider doing to meet their own kind of management objectives, whether it be for deer habitat or songbird habitat or forest productivity. But there's a lot of resources to landowners out there that they don't know about. And so we try to kind of be the connector of those dots out there.
Well, that's really incredible right there. I know you're about to mention something else, but before you, if you could hold that thought and we could just say, let's say someone has a piece of land, how much is, like, is it, let's say you just have a backyard Is that big enough to get in contact?
We do. So one of our partners for this project is Wisconsin DNR. And for the criteria for to be eligible for some of their programs, you have to have 5 acres or more.
Okay.
So that's kind of our threshold for this program. It doesn't mean that if you have less, there isn't some good information that we share. So we have an e-newsletter and a website. But then what we do is kind of actively wherever there are needs or opportunities across the state, like if you remember that big blowdown from the straight line winds up in northern Wisconsin a couple of years ago.
Yes, yes,
we really helped. Like we have a database of all the landowners in the state, and we helped landowners up there understand the state and federal programs that could help them clean up their woods and salvage the timber and those kind of things. You know, we only have limited capacity, so we try to work where the need or the opportunity is greatest. But otherwise, we have background education and information going out to landowners all across the state. So anybody interested in that should check out the website, My Wisconsin Woods, and sign up for the e-newsletter, because once a month we have all sorts of programs you could sign up for, classes you could take, or, you know, just information about your woods that might be helpful and relevant to you.
That's great. And so kind of whatever you want to do with your woods, you guys can kind of cater it to that, you know, sort of within reason, you know, if you want to probably
Well, like my point is people aren't preserving their woods. They own it for a reason. They either want to hunt on it, or they want to hike on it, or they need to get income off of it. All of those, if done as, you know, right, have ecological benefits and opportunities. And so we want to connect people up with those, just help them be intentional about, okay, if this is what the values I want to get off the land, how do I do that best, you know, most ecologically sensitive and thoughtfully?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a real good distinction between preserving and utilizing that. But that's right back to Aldo Leopold of being sort of a utilitarian with the land. And the more people that do, even if you want to farm or log or whatever, if you do that the right way, it's going to be a net win.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And then what was the other thing you were going to say before I interrupted?
Well,
you?
I think, you know, if unlimited budget, different opportunities. One, we just give a copy of a Sand County Almanac to everybody in the state of Wisconsin and beyond, you know, just to get them to read and think about the world in these ways. And then the other would be, again, what we talked about is just finding these alignments of economic need and opportunity with ecological systems. So my model was the New York City drinking water. But again, it would be continuing to produce valuable timber resources in the state of Wisconsin that drive our economy and create the land health, keep the land healthy and create recreational opportunities. And so, you know, that innovation between of connecting ecological integrity with economic opportunity is a space that just needs more time, investment, and thought.
No, I love that. Yeah. So it would just be finding different ways of finding those things and connecting it with people and sort of being creative with it.
So right now we have a collaboration with the U.S. Forest Service in the eastern region, which is basically Minnesota to Missouri, over to Maryland and up to Maine. So a pretty good chunk of the country. And that's what we're looking for, these stories of where communities are coming together and kind of improving land management practices to provide ecological and cultural values that you know, return to the bigger community. And like one project or effort's called Wild Harvest. And it's about how, berries and hunting and fishing produce not only dietary and caloric needs for communities, but also create local economies that need to be protected and enhanced. So that's kind of what we're on the hunt for right now, is where this is happening out there. The Menominee Forest is a great example in Wisconsin of the Menominee Nation that has managed their forest for generations. The forest is healthier than a lot of the surrounding forests. So again, when done right, you get healthy land and you get a healthy economy.
Folks, that's all for now. But if you want to listen to my full conversation with Buddy, just check out the Cripescast anywhere you get your podcasts.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Fox Valley's home of Mino and the Mayor.
Hey, it's John Mino.
And Jim Schmidt from Mino and the Mayor.
Want to stay in the loop with all things Northeast Wisconsin? Sign up for the WISS weekly newsletter.
Get the latest local stories, updates on the weather, and a special feature from our Mino and the Mayor podcast.
It's your one-stop shop for real news and great conversations in Northeast Wisconsin.
Log on to WISS.FM today and get signed up.
Real news, great conversations. Get signed up today at WISS.FM/newsletter. This is your local civic media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at...
Thank you for listening to WISS Berlin, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation. A civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. The suspect in the shooting death of the CEO of United Healthcare could waive extradition to New York as soon as Tuesday. ABC's Ike Jonchik is in New York.
Sources telling ABC News the 26-year-old allegedly shot and killed Thompson after fixating on him for months. Investigators say they recovered a spiral notebook after arresting him. That notebook allegedly showing a growing hatred toward United Healthcare and its chief executive, resulting in the execution-style murder.
FBI agents and NYPD detectives spoke to suspect Luigi Mangione's mother one day before he was arrested in Pennsylvania. Drone sightings causing growing concern among local officials in New Jersey. Sightings reported along the East Coast as far north as Boston. New York's governor saying, quote, this has gone too far after a drone sighting shut down Stewart Airport's runways. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Jordan saying the U.S. has been in direct contact with the Syrian group that ousted President Assad. This is ABC News.